Welcome once again to another fantastic episode of the Business Creators Radio Show. We help business creators like you win at the game of business and marketing so you can thrive from your intersection of your brilliance and your passion and make a difference for your community, market, and audience. Please take a moment and visit our website, www.businesscreatorsradioshow.com. You'll find hundreds of episodes covering a breadth and depth of topics relevant to you as a business creator, and links to subscribe via your favorite network so you get fresh episodes delivered straight to you. And now, here's today's episode. Let's get started.
Hi, my name is Adam Homey. I am your host, and I am honored once again by your wise decision to tune in and invest in yourself today. The Business Creators Radio Show takes you into the field where you have those aha moments and mastermind meetings that can change your life and bring you closer to serving from your intersection of your brilliance and your passion. You may hear birds chirping, cars driving by, ambient noise from a nearby table. But are these the things you hear when you have these encounters that transform your trajectory? Right now, as I sit out on my balcony here in Las Vegas, known to some as the hottest city in America, I'm not sure how good my noise cancellation is on my headphones, but you might hear an air conditioner running in the background because I can sure as hell hear it. This is where it happens. It's not in some soundproof $25,000 Hollywood studio. It's not in your office, and it's not in some formal, as Jack Welch would like to say, pompous ass thing. This is how it really works in the world. And we love the mastermind format of our episodes. And I am very excited about today's topic. It's timeless, and it's something that we can candidly never really get enough information about, if you ask me. And this is going to be about business taxation. And we have somebody here who has a really interesting take on it. We're going to talk about taxation for business. We're going to talk about tax planning. We're going to discuss cash flow management. It's one thing to have accounting based on compliance. It's another to have accounting based on strategic planning. And that's the bridge that we're going to gap for you, or that we're going to close the gap for you on today. To guide us in this journey, we have John Briggs. He is the founder of Insight Tax and Consulting. So he's also the author of a book called Profit First for Micro Gyms, which are small gyms. He's an accountant and accomplished business entrepreneur with a mission to help other brick and mortar business owners achieve their goals without burning out. He has more gym clients than any other firm in the United States, as well as thousands of other client-driven businesses. John knows firsthand the stress and unknown hurdles that come with starting a new business, and he guides entrepreneurs to financial success through cash flow management while also banishing the toxic CPA culture of being overworked and underpaid. Now, before I introduce John, I'm just going to say on a personal note, when I started my business in 2003 as a side hustle, before I created a virtual team and leverage and all that, the very first thing I did was found a really good CPA who's also a CIE, which is Certified Internal Auditor, who understands not only tax compliance, but also tax planning. He's been a priceless asset to my business, has guided me through so many things, and has enabled me to have a fundamental understanding of how the numbers of my business work without having to have my head split open with a migraine over trying to fill out the damn paperwork. And he has done a great job of fulfilling his mission of making sure that my business complies with every single federal, state, and local requirement in terms of what we need to file, what we need to pay, and not a damn cent more. At the same time, taking a forward-looking strategy of how do we make the cash flow work to achieve our investment attraction goals. And with all that, when I share all that, because I feel the gentleman we're about to meet is of a similar caliber, which is why I'm so excited to speak with him. John Briggs, come on in. The weather's fine.
Thanks for having me, Adam. I'm excited to be here.
Okay. I hate numbers, but one thing about my CPA is he loves numbers. He geeks out on them. So What we want to do is we want to go to brilliance and passion before you share with us some of the points you brought up in the green room that we're going to work our way through. Tell us a bit. I read off your official bio. Very impressive. Not sure I'm worthy to be here, and this is my show. Tell us a bit about your journey in your own words and what's brought you to where you are today, serving business creators from your intersection of your brilliance and your passion. In other words, the behind the curtain and between the lines view.
Yeah. So I have a master's degree in tax from BYU, and BYU does a really good job of teaching accountants, like most accounting programs, how to become a cog in the wheel of the accounting industry. And I experienced that with Deloitte, one of the big four, billion-dollar company. And when I was working there, I noticed there was some massive inefficiencies. To one end was with me getting promoted and rewarded based on my billable hours, yet I didn't control my workflow. There was only like one or two people in the entire office that control the workflow for everybody. And if you're more efficient than everybody else, you could get penalized because you're not necessarily controlling workflow. So I actually spent a lot of time going around asking other people when I was done with my work, hey, do you have something else for me to work on? And what I noticed is with the way the billing model works is clients eat that inefficiency. Like just because the office can't manage itself or have more autonomy, clients are paying bills that are higher than they should be because you have team members working on it who don't want to be penalized for being more productive than the other people.
Yeah.
That was kind of my intro to like, wow, I don't know if I love this. I love the work, but the industry, this kind of stinks. And through experience of working in two other smaller firms, I decided to go on my own and really rewrite the way that accountants are treated by their employers. Our accountants averaged 43 hours a week during tax season this last year.
Wow.
Yeah.
I think my CPA averaged 43 hours per day.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. So you have the small business owners on one hand who are like, they're just so overworked and they're trying to get through it with the deadlines. And then you have the big four who require a minimum of 55 hours a week worked. And in order to get the 55 minimum to not be fired, it's really 65 hours of real life. And that's just to not be fired. So,
wow.
We have a really good thing going on here, and I'm thrilled to try to change the accounting industry. And in the meantime, saving our clients a crap ton of money when it comes to keeping the money in their pocket, as opposed to paying Uncle Sam.
Yeah, I think that's great. And you know, when I worked in corporate, I encountered some of the same stuff. It's like actually getting punished for doing a really good job and being told by my supervisor, unofficially, but very clearly, to take it easy. Remember, there's plenty for tomorrow. And if people see me doing a lot of great stuff, they're going to give me more great stuff to do. And that builds a lot of resentment when the person in the cubicle next to you has their job because of nepotism, and they spend the entire day screaming into the phone, arguing with their significant other. Or, and this was back 20 years ago, back in the day before memes as we understand them, as you may recall from 20 years ago, memes were email forwards. So I remember once I'm diligent, doing a good job. I'm actually innovating something. And meanwhile, I have to listen to somebody who forwarded a funny email to 12 people and then called each of them to have a conversation about the email. And now on the other end, you're telling me that in these corporate accounting firms you worked for, you were mandated to actually work 55 hours a week just to keep your job. And you point out the fact that a 55 hour work week is actually a 65 hour work week once you throw in things like commuting, all the stuff that's not you actually working per se on clients, the meetings, the political bullshit, and everything else. So by the time you're done being required to do 55 hours a week, well, what if you can do somebody's tax return in 2 hours? Then what do? You bring up that point. Like, for example, through our conversation, I'm going to keep comparing to my own situation, just because it illustrates your points and the validity of them, is for my company's business filings and my own personal filings, that barely takes 10 hours per year because of how streamlined our processes are. It does not take long at all. But I could see you, but I could see becoming a client of one of those corporate tax firms and have my stuff being handed to you and you being told you have to find a way to spend 20 hours on me.
Yeah. And if you get it done sooner, you know, when we look at your data, you're going to have less billable hours than the other guy who is taking 40 hours on that return.
Yeah. How long does it take to do a business and a personal tax filing on an S Corp limited liability company with one managing partner that's in the mid range of six digits? I mean, how long does that really take?
Yeah. I mean, you're an hour ish, not 10.
Especially when it's all in QuickBooks already. And most of what you have to do is reconciliations, run reports to get balance sheets and data is based on classification and plug it into the 1120S. I mean, how hard is that?
Yeah.
Exactly. I mean, I don't want to do it myself, but I can read my 1120S well enough to understand where every single one of the numbers in it comes from.
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously this is a massive problem. And it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure it out that there's just, how about we just do the work for the amount of time it takes us, and then we move on to the next thing. We're all about value creation in our company. That's one of our big models. And if you can get through a return in 30 minutes, then get through a return in 30 minutes. That's one of the reasons why we can stay down to 42 hours, because when we're working, we're focused. We're efficient. We're capable people.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah. I prefer to pay somebody who knows it so well they can work efficiently. To me, that tells me they know what they're doing, rather than having to go back and look everything up.
Yes.
I mean, that's a confidence builder for me when somebody tells me they can do it in less time. In fact, I'm inclined to pay them more because I have a higher level of confidence. I'm not paying for their training.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So in your view, and let's look at this, first of all, from the business owner's perspective, what is one of the greatest challenges they face concerning their finances?
One of the greatest challenges that we come across is they're not giving themselves adequate time to focus on it. They're kind of using the hope and pray method, which isn't a great business strategy. It's like, hey, you know what? Revenue, great. I'm going to try to grow my revenue. It's super sexy. Lots of shiny objects out there to help us get more revenue. And hopefully if I get enough revenue, there's going to be money left over after I pay all these bills. So they're not really taking the time to even see, do I need all these bills? Maybe I overcommitted or have some unnecessary expenses. Maybe I have clients who actually I'm losing money on. Sometimes we get thrilled by the client who's willing to pay us, you know, say 10 grand a month. And then we realize, but it's costing me $8,000 of labor. And if that $8,000 of labor was serving other clients at a higher, you know, efficiency rate, we would make 20 grand instead of 10 grand. So they're not taking the time. They're just so busy on putting out fires and all the other stuff that comes up, right, as business owners. I know it's a simple answer, but really setting aside some dedicated time to look at your business finances and then in turn see how that trickles to affect your personal life. Most people don't want to work forever. And so having plans in place that allow you, should you choose to want to, not because you have to leave your business. You know, it'd be nice to have a safety net there of a plan.
Yeah, I think that's something. And a lot of us, when we first become entrepreneurs, it does become about how do we raise revenue quickly? How do we really get this thing going? And looking at it from a client attraction standpoint, that can easily translate into you find a couple of referral partners that will send you volume and you'll take on whatever crap they hand you. Does that sound familiar?
Sounds very familiar. I mean, uh-huh. I literally just bought a bookkeeping firm a couple months ago, and we're going through it, and I'm looking at the labor hours, and it's like, holy cow, we got to raise prices on some of these people. This is how we did it before. Like, okay, no, that's cool. And there's a reason that the business needed to be sold though. So
yeah.
Let's not put ourselves in a scenario where we're doing work and losing money doing it. That's silly.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. So, switching back to the CPA or the tax professional's perspective on this, I guess the next thing I would ask is, let's stick with where we are for the moment. The whole thing about all these hours they have to work. And yeah, I know that even an efficient CPA is going to be putting a lot of hours in during March and April, which is when a lot of filings are due. And then there's usually a bumper crop in September and October when all the extensions are due.
Mm-hmm.
So how do they balance all that stuff and not become a permanent slave to their business?
Well, the first step is to realize that it's not healthy. Whether you feel like your business needs you to work 55, 60, 70, 80 hours a week during the busy seasons doesn't mean it's healthy, doesn't mean it's a good idea. Oftentimes, what happens is because they undercharge and they're not making the type of margins they should on their clients, they keep bringing on more work because they think somehow that's going to lead to more net income. But if I'm selling widgets with no margin, it doesn't matter how many widgets I make, I have no margin. So that's one of the biggest things is most small business accountants that I've come across that I try to help, they undervalue what they actually are bringing to the table. It's like, wow, you saved that guy tens of thousands of dollars. You should be charging more than $200 for the return. So getting them to fix the pricing is the first step. The next step then is to have a better way to communicate with your clients. So at our firm, this extension season, which is usually September and October, it's not even a big deal for us. No one's working over 40 hours a week because we communicate with our clients all throughout the year. So they know that we want them to get their tax return filed because there's no reason why they shouldn't do it as soon as possible. And most accountants, because they overwork themselves in the beginning of the year, kind of go incognito. They disappear for the summer months and then they come back to work hard again, which happens to actually not be really appreciated by their clients because the clients are like, I can't get a hold of you and I have a question.
Yeah.
So it kind of a combo of pricing plus better systems. I'm oversimplifying some of the intricacies of probably what they need to do, but those two things would go a long way for most accountants.
Yeah, I think that's the case. So the next thing I'm curious about here is, again, now we're going back to the business owner, is how are we as entrepreneurs leaving money on the table year after year? I know just from some comments we got when we announced this episode was coming out, people wanted me to ask these questions of you. So what are some of the things we're doing? And this could be an interesting conversation about what is deductible, what isn't, and what should be. Yeah. So go ahead and tell us about some of the things you've seen.
Yeah. Let's start with the basic one that is just, general business owner mindset needs to be, if I'm spending money and I can relate it to my business in any form, shape, or fashion, that makes it a deduction. I won't go into the crazy nitty-gritty of how the IRS defines business expenses that are deductible as ordinary and necessary, which doesn't make any sense. So then they added like this additional definition of helpful and appropriate, all of it super vague. So the best thing for the business owner to understand is if they can relate it to their business, meaning it helps their business stay in business or grow in any form, shape, or fashion, then it's a business expense. It needs to be paid for on the business credit card or out of the business account. That's the bare minimum And then we ask, usually have people go back and say, well, we'll just go review your statements over this last year. I guarantee you got expenses that you might have paid for on your personal credit card that are really business expenses. So I would say that's the first foundational step, Adam.
Yeah. And, you know, we run into some challenges with that. First of all, I'm going to point out that a few years ago, I ran into somebody who was interested in starting a business. She worked in corporate, but she was going to take the side hustle to full-time route as far as the entrepreneurial thing. So she wanted to get it started. And one of the questions she had for me was, could I speak, you know, could I arrange for her to have a conversation with my CPA? Sure, I'm happy to refer a business. Second question was, well, in general, what do you need to, as far as stuff to have a business? And she said that she believed that she would not need to set up a separate checking account for her business because she's really good with QuickBooks and can easily sort out what on that statement is business and what is personal. I had to laugh.
Right. You know, if you're audited, the IRS will always get a copy of all of your bank statements, all of them.
Yeah.
And if they notice, which they will in this case, that everything's in your personal name and it's just personal accounts, you are in for a very unpleasant experience with the IRS. And if you have, if you actually set up a business from a standpoint of an LLC or an S corp, you're even in bigger trouble because the IRS will submit this form to themselves. It's weird how they do that, but it's called the alter ego form. And they say, hey, this person has a business, but based on how the way they're treating it, they don't really have one. So let's go ahead and tack on an additional 15.3% self-employment tax on top of all the other money they made. Very painful. As a general rule, every business should have a separate business bank account. And I recommend, for simplicity of accounting and organization, to have a separate business credit card. Even if it's in your personal name, identify a card you're going to use that is just for business purposes.
Yeah. I mean, it's a separate conversation of how to get true business credit cards and true business credit. One of the things that I found out very painfully about 7 years ago is I had four credit cards in the business that were identified as business cards that even had the word business on them, but they were linked to my social security number, which means they were showing up on my personal credit. That was not my intention. My intention on that was to build business credit. So I paid all those off. I use them like a couple times a year just so they don't get canceled on me. But the bottom line with that is that, it's again, just not only from a deductibility standpoint, from a common sense standpoint, to put all your business stuff in one place and all your personal stuff in another place. So here's another one of those things. It's almost a truism, and you're probably going to chuckle at the simplicity of this, of what I'm about to say. Back in 2003, when I decided that work I was doing on the side for my buddy who had the training and development company, I decided I wanted to build a real business out of that. And it evolved into what in today's terminology we would call a side hustle. The very first thing I did was form a limited liability company and seek a federal tax ID for the business. That's actually the original reason I hired the CPA, is to facilitate the process of getting the business tax ID. And then I worked with Nevada corporate planners to get the LLC stuff set up. But after I told people this, they said, well, you know, why are you going through all that? Because my friend who's a lawyer says you could just be a sole prop.
Oh, yeah.
Go ahead. Okay. Please go ahead. Okay.
A sole, first of all, any good attorney is never going to encourage you to be a sole proprietor.
No, notice how I phrase that. My friend who's a lawyer, not my lawyer.
Right.
Because I don't think if they said my lawyer, they would have been saying that.
No, of course not. Because for those of you who don't know, now I'm not an attorney, but I know enough to tell you this. A sole proprietorship by definition is you. It means you didn't set anything up.
Right.
You might have gotten a DBA, which is a doing business as, so you have a different name, but it's
still
your social security number.
I heard that one too. Oh, I don't need a corporation. I got a DBA. Everything's separate. The corporate veil's there. I'm good to go. I said, awesome. No. That's great. And excuse myself from the conversation because I had to go somewhere and bust out laughing.
Yeah. So here, from a tax standpoint, the reason you want an entity is because, and this was the next thing anyways, as far as like where our business owners leaving money on the table, a low hanging fruit is making sure you have the right entity structure. So the income we make, the IRS likes to call it something like it's either ordinary income, self-employment income, passive income. Those are kind of the main three. Uh-huh. Well, as a business owner, the type of income you make is considered self-employment income. And what that means is you have self-employment tax tied to it. So those of you are maybe aren't aware, that's 15.3%. If you get a W-2, that you pay half as the employee, the employer pays the other half.
Yeah.
That's why we call it self-employment tax, because you get to pay both halves.
Yeah.
Now that is a tax on top of the income tax you are already going to have to pay regardless of the type of income you have. So as a sole proprietor, all of your net income from the business is going to be taxed with the additional 15.3%.
Yeah.
Even if you go and get a single member LLC and that's all you do, the IRS calls that a disregarded entity, meaning they don't give it any regard. They don't think it exists. So you're also going to pay the 15.3% tax on a single member LLC if you didn't make an election to tax it like an S corp.
Right. That's why I said I have an 1120 yep. S.
Exactly.
Yes.
Also know if you set up an LLC and there's more than one member, the IRS calls that a multi-member LLC, and its default status is to be taxed like a partnership. And if you're actively involved, you still have the 15.3% tax tied to it. A passive member of an LLC of a LLC taxes a partnership doesn't. So, I mean, you'll want to check with an accountant, but for many business owners who are service-based or product-based, chances are you're going to want an S corporation somewhere in your structure.
Yeah. I think that's like so key. And, you know, with what we're seeing today, with how careers work and how the gig economy works and how multiple streams of income is becoming not so much an entrepreneurial dream, but more like just a way of life for everybody. I think that's where this is headed. It's my firm belief at this point that if you want to really do something good for your kids, get them an LLC for their 18th birthday.
Okay. Yeah. I mean,
yeah,
doesn't hurt to have it.
Yeah. I've run into folks who've had challenges with establishing credit because a lot of what they do is either cash-based or 1099 based rather than having an entity to run that through. So they're not even documenting income properly. They're paying more taxes than they should. And also sometimes they're not paying taxes that they should, where technically what they're doing may be legal, but what it's doing is it's getting in the way of them having a prosperous lifestyle because it cuts them off from access to credit.
Mm, yeah.
Yeah. Have you seen anything like that?
Not from the access to credit standpoint. We don't get too heavily involved in that with our clients, right. But I mean, I definitely see a lot of my clients teaching their children how to even set up a business while they're still in high school.
Yeah.
So 18 might be too late, depending on what you're teaching your kids to do. I'm currently trying to help my son create an Amazon business. So we got an LLC set up and because based on how things are going, I don't want him to be reliant on somebody else for his living.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I, again, that can be very, well, really, really challenging. And another thing that I see, and maybe you have some insights on this. So let's say anything having to do with your living situation, whether you are looking to buy a house, to take out a mortgage to buy a house, whether you're looking to rent an apartment or finance a condo or something along those lines, and you have a business entity, and going back to what you said earlier, you should be looking for, and this is correct, things that support your business, and those should be deductions, and they should be clearly identified as business expenses coming through a business cash flow mechanism. So what happens to a lot of us is we end up, to put it very simply, expensing a lot of our lifestyle through the business, and it's perfectly legal to do so. Then when you want to rent something or buy something, there are two things that come up over and over in the conversation. They're looking for you to have personal income that's X amount of times the mortgage or the rent or something like that. And then just when you think that you've worked your way through the system, some ninth person in the process comes along and says, "We need to see your pay stubs." And I say that with mocking derision on purpose.
Yeah. I've definitely seen this. So there's a few things a business owner should probably be aware of. As an accounting firm, we are all about maximizing the tax code to its full extent possible.
Yeah.
Keep right as much savings as possible. In the scenarios, though, because sometimes we are able to write off these expenses, it might be more considered living expense than business expense. You may not show enough income to even qualify for the loan. So we do always recommend, if it's in the works or you're thinking about it, to speak to an under or a mortgage guy to at least get an idea of how much income you may need to show.
Yeah.
Because as a business owner, you can choose to be way less aggressive on what expenses you claim, which, you know, increases your taxable income, but the way the mortgage rules work, you'll have the income to show. Yeah. And then on the flip side, what you're saying, I mean, I hate dealing with underwriters with lending. I mean, you can imagine we have thousands of clients. I mean, we are constantly trying to help our clients get the documentation they need. And even those who ask for the W-2, if you have business income, they are going to look at your full business. If you have a main W-2 job and you're just working on a side hustle that's your business, you're probably okay as long as your W-2 shows enough income. But as soon as you get to the point where your business is what supports you and it's your main source of living, they are going to uncover everything. They're always going to have to dig into the business, which is not a straightforward process like it is if you're getting a loan based on a W-2. And, your there's a balance there between what you claim on your W-2 and the way it affects your net income.
Yeah.
And I had a client who did not believe me, and unfortunately he suffered the cost because of it. He's like, "Yeah, I need to get a loan. So I'm going to take all my net income and I'm going to put it on a W-2. So what that means is, from a tax standpoint, everyone, his adjusted gross income, what he pays tax on, doesn't change.
Right.
It's just like a teeter totter. More is on the side of the W-2 and there's nothing now on the business side. Where if you would have left the W-2 where it was, he has some still showing his business income. He's like, "No, I want on the W-2. I want to qualify." I'm like, "You're a business owner and this is your main source of living. They're going to look at everything." So all he did was unnecessarily pay payroll tax on an additional $70,000, and he didn't end up qualifying for the loan anyways.
Yeah. That's one of the things. You go through the work and then it's still doesn't happen. And one of the things that's been an ongoing struggle, not only for myself, but for a lot of people I know, is persuading landlords, mortgage lenders, credit card companies, whatever, to look at the business. I mean, if you want to just look at my W-2, you're going to look at that number and you're going to ask, "Why don't you work at McDonald's? You'd be better off."
Right.
Because there are these things called shareholder distributions. This is why I became proficient reading my 1120S, because I've had to explain this over and over and over again, where I've had to say, go to page 3 in section, I think it's 16, line D. If I'm off by one, look at this number, and then go to page, I think it's 7 of my personal 1040, and notice how this number matches this number, and then it goes into this deduction flow. And this is how you see what the income actually is.
I've had hundreds of similar conversations.
Yeah.
I actually don't understand. That industry is another one that's broken. Hey, here's an idea. Let's use tax returns that we don't understand as the main component for us to determine if we should lend money to this person, which is the way we make money. Like, it's the dumbest structure ever.
Well, yeah. And you also see that a lot in the rental industry. And I bring that up because we're seeing this trend here, not only in the United States, but throughout the world. It's actually away from home ownership and more towards perpetual rentership. And there's a number of factors. First of all, it's the scarcity of available housing. Second, it's, well, I don't even know if this is second, this might actually be first. It's changes in mores of lifestyles. The idea that you're going to, at age 23, decide what your whole life is going to be, and you're going to buy a house right down the street from your parents, and you're going to spend 30 years paying it off. That's kind of hilarious when people change careers an average of 8 times and move to different states an average of 4 times.
Yeah. And then throw in interest rates,
yeah,
which is, you know, the same house at the same price with a higher interest rate is inflation.
I've been a renter for all the time I've been on my own, and I've heard the argument that, well, you know, you're just giving money away and you're getting nothing back, and it's not an asset and you're not building anything, and you should buy a house. And I say, I'm familiar with all those arguments. I just don't care.
Yeah.
It doesn't support my lifestyle. The primary value on how I live and where I live is portability. If I don't like the management, if things turn sideways, I decide I want to pick up and go to another state, or I just want to pick up and go to another part of town. The only inhibitors I have to that is how long I have left on my 12-month lease and whether or not I'm willing to pay a break fee to get out sooner.
Yeah, I think it's critical people start matching the way they run business, they run their life with the way they want to, as opposed to just accepting, well, this is the way I was taught. I guess this is the way I do it.
Yeah. Right. So again, I think, you know, the rental industry has some breakage in it because there's still way too much looking at factors that don't apply to a lot of folks. I mean, where do you think people who drive Uber for a living live? I mean, do you think they live in houses? The nature of their job is transitory, so the nature of their life is probably transitory as well. They're more likely to live in an apartment, so they get paid, I think it's direct deposit into their bank account from Uber every so often. I don't know if it's like on a fixed schedule or whether they just go into their balance and pull it out. I'm not sure how that works, but they're not going to get a taste of it because they're responsible for their own taxes. The purpose of a pay stub is to document what was taken out in taxes.
Yeah.
And whereas with someone like me or someone who owns a company and transfers business to personal and vice versa, somebody who's a gig worker, somebody who's a 1099 worker, the definition of all those things in common is we're also responsible for making sure we pay those taxes that an employer would take out if we just did a W-2 lifestyle.
Yeah. The IRS would like every business owner, to make estimated payments. They want that money every 3 months.
Well, yeah, and I do that. I file my 941s and I make quarterly payments on that. So and I've always been in the habit of doing that. And candidly, I wish more people did because I know so many folks who don't. I also know people who have INC, like incorporations or limited liability companies or limited liability partnerships or what have you, who don't take salaries. They just take distributions. And so essentially, yeah, they on the back end, they end up doing their Social Security and everything else, but there's nothing that shows by default that they're paying anything to society unless they go through three hoops to prove it.
Yeah. And what you're referring to there, so if you end up setting up an S corporation, the IRS requires owners of an S corp who work in the business to pay themselves a reasonable wage.
Yeah.
So it is one of the reasons why some people hear that and they're like, oh, then I'm not going to do an S corp. I promise the tax savings and the reduced self-employment tax is totally worth it, where you will likely be saving more money in taxes than what you would pay a professional to handle your payroll filings for you.
Yeah.
And in the past, people haven't done that. And so what they do is they basically file their wage on their personal return on a Schedule C so that they, quote unquote, pay the self-employment tax without actually going through the headache of doing W-2 payments. I can tell you as of right now, the IRS is cracking down on that. And it's just better to do the formal W-2 quarterly 941 filings if you find yourself in that S-corp boat.
Uh-huh. And if so a question I like to ask, and this is and some people find this provocative, is why do a lot of porn stars work as realtors?
I don't know.
Well, it's real simple. Being a realtor is a sunlight job that allows you to, within reason, set your own hours so you can sell houses around the photo shoots. And then you have a place to run the money so you can show it to the government and it's legitimate income.
Huh.
Yeah, we have a lot of that here in Las Vegas, particularly. And you also see a lot of that in Southern California. So it's something I'm kind of familiar with. So, and it goes, and it just goes, it just, you know, very graphically illustrates the whole point of, to me, it's valuable to participate in the system because of the benefits it gets you. And there are other ways of getting the savings. So you may think that, oh, I'm just going to skip the W-2, but then that 15.9% is going to hit you. And then not only that, but that's the first thing that people who are looking to ask questions, that's the low hanging fruit for them.
Mm-hmm.
So I do take what I've been advised by two people is a reasonable salary. And I do take a significant portion in distributions as well, but I also keep the formula very simple. So when I get asked about it 50 times a year, I know it by heart. and 49 out of 50, it only takes me a minute to explain it to them and they understand.
Yeah.
So now let's get into cash flow management. And I think this is where this is headed. So first of all, what stage of business is it important to have this? And what I'd like you to do, if possible, is tie cash flow management to tax planning, because there's a correlation there that sadly not enough people I know see.
Okay. So, you know, whether you're in business, have been in business for 10 years, 20 years, whether you're in a growth stage or you're a mature business and you're just looking to keep the revenue the same, or you're a startup, cash flow management is necessary because at any point or stage in your business, you have cash. It needs to be managed. It's just that simple. Cash is king. It's the lifeblood of your business. So when we talk about cash flow management, the first thing I got to explain is this thing called Parkinson's Law. And what it says is it says the demand for something will expand to match its supply. So think about it this way. Most business owners have a bank account, one bank account. That bank account is a pile of supply in the form of cash. The demand for that cash will continue to expand until there's no more cash left to spend.
Oh, yeah.
That's Parkinson's Law. So what we say when it comes to cash flow management is we're like, okay, we need to set ourselves up in a scenario where we give ourselves a fake sense of reality that we have less money to spend than we really do. And the way we do that is we recommend setting up a couple other business bank accounts so that we can set aside some money into those for things we know that are going to happen. For example, as the owner, I love my team and they're very important, but I am the most important employee of my company. Owners are the most important employee of their company. So having a bank account specifically dedicated to owner's pay, making sure the owner gets paid at least something reasonable, so that they don't get burnt out and close down the business, very critical.
Yeah.
As you manage your cash better, and the hopes are you have a profitable business, you're going to owe tax. Yeah, we're going to minimize it, but you're still going to owe something. So setting aside money for tax, also super important. A third category we like is, okay, you're working in the business. We have the owner's pay account to take care of you for that. But you also took a risk as the owner that none of your other team members did, which is owning the business. Look, if your business fails, they're going to go out and get another job somewhere else. You're left with a business that closed, and sometimes that can take years to unravel some of that stuff. So the risk that you should be rewarded for, right? You took it on, you should get a reward in turn. Wall Street calls that ROI, return on investment. You have equity ownership. So there should be an account set aside for profit distribution, which also, the way we use it, has a secondary benefit that it also starts accruing a bit of a cash reserve balance for you, because I'm sure people have heard from an individual standpoint, having 3 to 6 months of your expenses in savings is healthy and, you know, good. Same idea with business. You don't want to be living business life paycheck to paycheck either.
Yeah.
So those are three categories we like. The way cash flow management ties in specifically to tax planning, I don't know if anyone listening has ever been in this situation, but you probably haven't, but you probably know other business owners who have. It comes April, you get your tax return back from your accountant. They get their tax return back from their accountant, and it says you owe $2,000, $3,000, $10,000. And they think, how is that possible? Where's that money? I don't know.
Uh-huh.
I don't have that money.
That happened to me. That happened to me 1 year. We had an extremely profitable year. And then at the end of it, I'm finding out from my CPA, he says, he tells me, before we file this, we might want to look again at your deduction strategy for the previous year, because you're going to have a hefty tax bill. So we got to dig a little bit deeper and see if there's anything else that we can claim here. And that number is actually very similar to what I was told. And as soon as I heard that number, I'm thinking, okay, so if I did so well in that business that I have this money, much liability, where the hell did that money go?
Mm-hmm. And so without a plan, Parkinson's law is what happens, right? We spent it on other stuff. Hey, we're business owners. We're optimistic. I'm going to invest in this. It's going to result in this. And we just, the money's in the account. I see it. Let's spend it. So with the proper cash flow management system, like we're suggesting, we recommend people sit down once a week or twice a month, either one of those frequencies, but one of those two frequencies is really best practice. And you set aside a small amount of your income into these accounts.
Right.
So as you're going, so I might only set aside $1,000 or $2,000 per time, but at the moment, it doesn't hurt me. I can run my business without that money.
And it adds up. It adds up fast. You know,
it adds up real fast.
Yeah. I'll tell you another thing. About a year ago, I got $8,000 from a private funding source, dropped it in the business checking account. And then 45 days later, I blinked. It's like, how is this bank account down to $32? What the hell happened to $8,000? And the best part is, I looked at my bank statements. I couldn't find anything extraordinary. But I'll tell you what happened is I got a little lax. I stopped paying attention because I thought, oh, there's a lot of money in the account. I don't have to obsess over this. But see, now I know, because I've gotten other cash injections. I've gotten paid on podcast reach projects, which are high ticket. And I've developed a discipline. And when this money comes in, grab that money or a piece of that money and just put it in a separate account or into a separate place where there's no way possible that it could get deducted by ACH by any ordinary daily expense.
Exactly. And that is where, really what we're doing is we're setting up boundaries around this cash so that it's being protected. And as you said, it adds up. So our clients who run this method, you know, they'll get to April and they might have that initial like, whoa, I owe 10 grand in tax. Then they'll look at their tax account and they've saved $15,000. And they're like, oh, cool. I already have the money and I oversaved. So now I can take the other 5,000 and, you know, do whatever I want with it.
They have a choices. So $13,000 and you find out you have a tax liability of 2,000. Take that out. You got 11 grand left. So you have a lot of things you can do. You can spend the 11 grand on investments. You can say, okay, well, I don't need 11 grand either. So I'm going to take 5 grand. I'm going to invest that, but now I still have the 6. So next time I have a really profitable year and I wonder where the hell the money went, well, here it is. And then I'll put a little bit more in the meantime. So I'll be good again.
Yeah. Or you can buy $6,000 of Reese's peanut butter cups.
You can do that too. and depending on the opportunities in your life, you could possibly resell them. Man, back in February of 2020, I should have thought about toilet paper.
Oh, right.
I remember that story of these people that when COVID became a thing, they went around to every store in their town and like 5 neighboring towns and bought all the hand sanitizer, like all of it. Mm-hmm. And I saw the pictures. They had this big room that was just stacked with boxes of hand sanitizer, and they tried to sell it online for exorbitant rates and got shut down.
That's right.
And there was public outrage over this. And I think the mistake that they made is how egregious they were with it. Actually, what they were doing is simply participating in capitalism, supply and demand. They saw an upcoming demand, so they invested in inventory so they could supply it. Now, I'm gonna make up numbers here because I don't even know off the top of my head. Let's say a bottle of hand sanitizer costs $3. So you know that there's going to be a big demand on it. So you buy... You pull together a few thousand dollars, you buy a whole bunch of hand sanitizer. Then the demand hits and the stores get emptied. Now you have this cachet of hand sanitizer. So now instead of charging $20 a bottle, whatever ridiculous rate they were going for, which set off all the alarm bells in the first place, now you start selling it for $5 a bottle a little bit at a time. They probably would have flown right under radar and got all their return on investment back plus a hefty profit.
Even if they doubled it.
Yeah, in fact, if they marketed that properly, they could have been viewed as good Samaritans.
Yeah. Instead of just doubling the price, they like 100x'd it or something crazy.
Exactly like that. So if I pay $3 for something and sell it for $5, I mean, I can't remember how the math works, but that's like 166% ROI or something like that, or 66% profit, or however you want to categorize that. That's pretty good.
You're not getting that in other places. Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, and with the demand for that stuff, if they would have just sold it a little bit at a time on different platforms, they would have flown under radar and made a mint.
Mm-hmm.
It's just going back to your point, not taking the time, even if it's twice a month, just an hour, or if you have a cash windfall, saying pause and grabbing a piece of that and just moving it aside because you don't need it right now. But if it's there and it's easily available, it will get used. Like the case of my $8,000 private loan, it just evaporated.
Right.
I also said, I didn't spend or invest in anything extraordinary. I just got a little lax on marketing and didn't bring in any high ticket deals for 6 weeks because I thought, oh, I have time. So I let my hustle go and won my money. Whereas if I had to grab that money and said, okay, 2,000, we're going to leave in the other 6 grand. I'm setting over to the rainy day fund. Well, yeah, I got $2,000. That's nice. And now I'm motivated to go get the other 6 through other means.
Yeah, it's such a simple behavior to adapt. And those of our clients that we've helped with do this, they get to the point, because it's pretty easy to adapt once you get it done a couple times. They'll even go to the the next step and say like, okay, I know that I have this expense every year and it's always a lot of money. I'm actually going to start setting aside money into another account just for that. So I do this myself. I call it my known big expense account, which I'm glad I do, because honestly, right now, September 15th to October 15th, my tax software bill comes due. My CRM comes due. I have a couple of memberships come due.
Yep.
And I have it's like an extra $130,000 of expenses that are not in my normal monthly flow.
Right.
And in the past years, I've had to put it on a credit card and pay it off over the next couple of months.
Uh-huh.
Where by setting aside money, it's like, okay, I got the money. I pay it off. Everything's great. And now I saved myself on the interest expense on my credit card. And now I just start setting aside money again because it doesn't hurt me every month. I'm just setting aside a little bit.
Well, yeah. Well, here's another thing just to cap off. And this is real low level. And I'm surprised that so many people don't know this, particularly in entrepreneurship. Two parts of this. One of the masterminds I belong to, it's $500 a month. Now, my payment is due not monthly, but every 30 days. So, you know, that means that the payment gradually slides backwards. And as it slides backwards, it hits different points in my regular cash flow, which means it could be in a wax period or it could be in a wane period. Mm. So I had these business credit cards paid off and I wanted to keep them active just so that they don't get shut down on me, because I like having all that credit available. So I took one of them and used it to pay for the mastermind. And then I have automatic payments set up on that card for the same amount. So every month it gets all the way paid off. And what's really cool is that card is particularly generous when it comes to cashback rewards. And that mastermind expense qualifies for the cashback rewards. So I'm getting a piece of my mastermind paid for simply because I'm paying for the mastermind. And I'm no longer fretting. That monthly due is going to slide back from the 3rd to the 27th. And that's going to be the same day that this happens. All that's gone now. And then here's the other thing. We invest in things as entrepreneurs. We, you know, masterminds. We go to seminars. We buy information products. And they're kind of high ticket. You remember a few years ago that seemed like every information product out there that was any good, they were all $1,997. And there was always a 6-payment option, which actually had a pretty hefty premium to it. So you ended up paying like $2,400 for it.
Yep.
So let's say you don't have 1997, or let's say you have the 1997, but you don't want to just hand that cash over all in one chunk. You have an empty business credit card that has a cashback rewards program. Use that credit card, use that to take the single pay option, just the 1997, and then log into your online portal for that credit card. Take that 1997, divide it by 6, and then have that be your automatic monthly payments on that card. And between those 6 payments and a little bit of left over after payment 7, you'll come out way ahead. I mean, yeah, you'll pay a little bit in interest, but it's not like an extra $500. And if there's cash back and that purchase qualifies, you may not only negate the interest, but actually get a few dollars back.
Yeah.
Plus, it's another payoff on your record, which can't hurt.
For sure. Establishing good credit.
So
we use credit cards as well. I think it's important for people to know who, like, accept who they are. I have some clients that have gotten themselves into so much trouble with credit cards.
Oh yeah.
And so not a great idea, but a lot of our clients, and I would say most business owners, are pretty disciplined. So we do the same thing. Now, look, I know no one became a millionaire off of the benefits from their credit cards. However, right. There are benefits. Like, I have great airline status with Southwest and American Airlines.
Right.
All through my credit card. And I log, when I sit down and put money into these different buckets, like I'm suggesting here, I do everything I suggest. I pay off my credit card at the same time. So I'm getting the benefit from whatever, you know, kickbacks they're getting for their merchant charges or sharing a little bit of it with us. Right.
Yeah.
I get that benefit, and no one's a millionaire, but I've been able to take my family of 6 to Florida and California for free. Just for spending money on a card that I was already spending.
The key to this is is don't float stuff without a plan to pay it off. Use the card, get the benefits, but don't just load them up with stuff that you have an indeterminate date that you're going to pay it off. So like I use the example of the mastermind, also like the 1997 purchase, there's a specific payoff plan that goes behind that. So it's not like I'm just building up a bunch of debt.
Exactly.
Yeah. And then like the 1997 model, well, if you were going to pay, make the 6 payments on an information product, you were going to have 5 additional hits on your checking account anyway. So all you're doing is transferring who the payee is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And saving on premium charges and possibly getting cash back. So yeah. We're at the top of the hour here, and I'd love to keep chatting on this for hours and hours and hours. I think you can tell I love this topic. But what I want to do now is for those of you who have listened to this and may have had some realizations that what you thought was an airtight plan for managing your cash flow, handling your taxation, your business structure, and how it supports these things, but might want to give it a second look, or may decide that now is the time to work with somebody who truly understands this and can also do it efficiently for you, go to John Briggs' website. It's at insighttax.com, insighttax.com. When you visit that website, as of this recording, you know, websites adjust, but you're going to see a lot of resources there. You're going to see the various services they offer. There's a resource center with a blog. There's some videos. There's some other stuff. You have the opportunity to get some free simple strategies on how to crush your taxes and keep more money by utilizing wealth creating strategies. It's all there. Go check it out. That's at insighttax.com. And with that, John Briggs, thank you so much for being with us today. It's been an honor, believe me, in education.
Thanks for having me, Adam.
We trust you enjoyed today's episode of the Business Creators Radio Show. Check out our previous and upcoming episodes on our website at www.businesscreatorsradioshow.com. While you're there, be sure to subscribe via your favorite network so you get fresh episodes delivered straight to you. Until next time, have a great day. Take care.